This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Percent of the food produced in this country is never eaten. It's a massive amount, and the waste goes beyond the wilted salads or moldy bread. It's wasted water for irrigation, land cleared for growing and grazing, fuel burned for processing and transportation. And so in recent years, environmental groups have really started to focus on this issue because of this connection. All that plus the fact that so much perfectly good food goes uneaten when so many people remain hungry. Today in The Exchange, we chew on this topic, including ideas for reducing waste at every stage, from farm to fork. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org or respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have two guests for the hour. Joanne Birkenkamp is with us, senior advocate with the Food and Agriculture Program of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Joanne, great to have you. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Also with us, Stephen Finn, Innovation for Sustainability Professor at the University of Pennsylvania and a founding partner of the Response Ecology Consulting Firm. And Stephen Finn, welcome to you, too. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Laura. Great to be here.
Well, Joanne, I'm going to start with you because that's an NRDC number. 40% of the food produced is never eaten. I just find that stunning. What's the biggest contributor to that giant number, Joanne? Because I cleaned out the fridge earlier this week. I'm feeling a little guilty about that moldy tomato sauce that I threw out.
Well, it is a huge number. I think for most of us, it's kind of shocking how big that number really is. And, you know, you asked about the biggest contributor to that. And unfortunately, although I think none of us wake up in the morning and think, okay, I'm going to set out and waste some food today. In fact, unfortunately, consumers are the largest contributor to our food waste challenges. And, you know, that has really shifted over time. Back in the 70s, for instance, we wasted about 50% less than we do today. So it really has increased over time. But as you pointed out, you know, there are losses that occur all the way from the farm to the fork. And I think the good news is that as, you know, as consumers, we all eat food, we all contribute to those challenges, but it also means we can all be part of the solution. And I know we'll have an opportunity to talk today about some really simple things that consumers can do to help address this challenge and reduce the amount of food that we all waste.
Wow, yeah, and especially relevant as people, you know, head into Thanksgiving at a time when you're buying a lot of food. But you said in the 1970s, Joanne, we wasted half as much. How come?
Well, you know, there have been a lot of changes in our lifestyles that have contributed to, for instance, the food that we waste at home. So, you know, for many of us, you might be cooking for kids who have different schedules every day. You might be cooking multiple meals. There might be food allergies that come into play. You know, people are, you know, challenged to prepare and eat foods at home and to plan how that's going to work. You know, we also find we're also very focused on getting a good deal when we shop at the grocery store, so we may be very focused on getting the two-for-one deal or the extra-large pack size or, you know, driving across town to think to get what we anticipate to be a better deal on something that's a larger size. But often when we buy extra food, we just may not be able to use it fast enough. So there are a lot of lifestyles that really contribute to this. And, of course, there are losses that occur in grocery stores, you know, things like very large produce displays. They look beautiful, right? They motivate us to buy, but often they contribute to more losses at the grocery store level. And those losses occur, you know, in manufacturing. They certainly occur in restaurants. I think most of us see that every time we go to the restaurants and see, you know, portion sizes that are much larger than we can possibly eat. So it really is a systems-level challenge that we face.
Sure. So, and we'll talk about all the spots in that system where this food waste occurs. But Stephen, I'd love your thoughts too. Jump in if you had to point the finger of responsibility to one aspect of this farm to fork waste. Is it me with my moldy tomato sauce and my smelly pasta?
Well, you know, the consumer piece is certainly a huge chunk of it. And Joanne just ticked off a lot of good reasons. you know, it is a systemic issue. If you kind of build up and summarize a lot of the points that she just said, I'd say it's a broad cultural thing. It's really a question of values. You know, if you think back to the war years, there was little waste of food because we simply couldn't afford to do that, right? We were encouraged to do everything we possibly could with food, to save it, to grow it for the troops, to grow it for ourselves, to save resources, right? So food was really highly valued, and our actions reflected that. We very quickly transitioned to this culture of abundance, right, where food is all around us. We're surrounded by it in big displays, in perfect displays, as Joanne alluded to. We equate value with size and with quantity. So really, you know, food is everywhere. We can get it at all times on a 24/7 basis in big quantities. So that really tends to breed this culture of abundance that we have. And, you know, frankly, we're spoiled. And that is really limited the value that we place on it. So
food is cheap.
I think that's the shift that needs to occur to move away from that abundance theme to a culture that values food more and where we take it more responsibly.
Well, and the theme that environmental groups have been promoting recently is, okay, it's cheap for us on the shelves maybe, but there's a huge environmental impact of all this food waste. Again, pretty jaw-dropping. And Stephen Finn, I'd love your thoughts first. I mean, the numbers are big, but try and put them in a way, please, that makes sense to people.
Yeah, the environmental issue is huge, right? You know, decaying food in landfills is a great, huge contributor to greenhouse gases. The statistic that always jumps out the most to me is that if food waste were ranked as a country, it would be the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases behind the U.S. and China. So that really puts things in perspective. You know, we're talking about, you know, 60 million tons of food wasted across the country.
So wait, hold on, Stephen. Let me make sure I got that right. So if food waste were a country, it would emit, it would be the third biggest greenhouse gas emitter? Is that what you're saying?
Right, behind the U.S. and China. And that is a staggering statistic that tends to wake people up a little bit.
So that's the emissions that come from food waste in a landfill, or does that also include, you know, the fuel burned for processing and transporting food?
Yeah, that's typically the landfill effect of rotting food in landfills.
Okay, so I can hear our listeners already, Joanne, going, wait, what about composting? What about that, Joanne?
Sure. Well, when you look at the emissions that are associated with food, they really, you know, begin at the farm and they go all the way through to the fork, you know, to our homes, and then into whatever means is used to dispose of it. So you can see those emissions all along the chain. So, for instance, when food is chilled and held to be cold to extend its shelf life, you know, you've got, you know, energy that's going into refrigeration. We're shipping it across the country. It has to be refrigerated. It's being cooked. It's being refrigerated or frozen in our homes and so forth. And then when you dispose of it, about a sixth of the emissions that are associated with food waste are related to what happens when you landfill it, right? And when food and other organic materials like yard waste are decomposed in a landfill environment, there's no oxygen. And when organics decompose in that environment, they generate and emit a lot of methane, right? And there's much less methane when you compost. So composting is a big improvement from an emission standpoint over landfilling. But, you know, it's also true, as Steve said, you know, the best benefit environmentally is when we don't waste food in the first place, right? And that's where you can help avoid all that water and the agricultural chemicals and the energy that are used to grow it and ship it in the first place. And part of the happy coincidence, Laura, with that is that those environmental benefits converge with the cost savings that consumers and businesses can enjoy when they avoid wasting food in the first place.
All right, lots more to talk about. And I want to remind our listeners, you can join us. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Today in the Exchange, we're looking at the giant pile of wasted food in this country. Up to 40% of the food produced, according to NRDC, is never eaten. And that's a lot of waste, not just the food itself, but the water, the fuel, the land involved in producing that food. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Again, email exchange@nhpr.org. You know, both of you, one of the things that I came across yesterday doing the research, another culprit in this, if I could put it that way, Stephen Finn, is the labels on products at the grocery store. You know, sell by, best consumed by, eat or freeze by. Where do those labels come from?
Yeah, there's, you know, those do cause a lot of confusion amongst consumers. There's a lot of there's so many of them, as you said, used by, best before, sell by. You know, they've been around for a while, and they're really, you know, consumers tend to look at them and see that date and say, oh, I have to throw out this food, you know, on this specific date, because otherwise why would that label be on the carton? They're really a source of confusion, and they're really more of an issue, more of an indicator on the manufacturer's end of sort of peak freshness. They're not really, in the manufacturer's view, they're not really an indicator of, you know, this food is good up till then, and after that it's going to cause a problem for you. So that, you know, date labeling, a huge issue in this country. Big
date labeling, that's what it's called. So who is in charge, Stephen, of date labeling?
FDA is working on, is involved in that. I think USDA is a piece of that too. There's a good group out of Harvard right now, the Food Law Policy Clinic, that is doing a lot of great work with date labeling and working to get some changes done to eliminate that source of confusion and simplify that across the country.
Now, I guess my question is, I hear you on people working on it, but who makes those date decisions right now, Stephen?
I think it's really the manufacturers that are making those decisions, and you know, according to their assessment of what peak freshness is in their products throughout the supply chain.
And Joanne, how do I, as a consumer, decide, you know, what's peak fresh or just a little past peak fresh, and what's spoiled and is going to make me sick?
Mm-hmm.
I take those dates very seriously.
Absolutely, and it's a very interesting dynamic, Laura. We often so typically see in families that people have different interpretations of what the date labels mean. So often we'll see couples where one person is like, "No, you absolutely have to throw it out on the date," and the other person is like, "No, just smell it, take a look at it, see what's going on in there before you throw it out." And I think there are really two myths that really underlie that dynamic. You know, one is, I think many people assume that, not unreasonably, but incorrectly assume that date labels are federally regulated. And in fact, that is not the case, other than infant formula. So the date labels really are set, as you said, by manufacturers, by the companies that make those foods. And it's really kind of a combination of art and science that's used to set the dates. So it may be based on the work of their food scientists to determine when something changes. It might be based on focus groups. It might be based on complaints from customers. You know, as a consumer, you wouldn't really, you know, have insight into how the dates are established. So, you know, that's something that consumers should be aware of. And then secondly, I think many people do assume that those dates are intended to mean that the food becomes unsafe
right after
the date, when in fact, you know, what they really are is the manufacturer's estimate of when the food, in fact, is at its peak quality. So it's important for people to, not always assume that the dates mean that you need to throw it out, to take a look at it, to smell it, to use your own judgment. And I think, as you know, many of us have stepped back from cooking, we've kind of, you know, let go of a sense that we are able to judge when something is good to eat or not. And that, you know, contributes to people just assuming that, you know, you look at the date and you pitch it. But it's important for people to use their own judgment.
So which one are you, Joanne? Are you the one who, you know, looks at the date and says, "I'm dumping this milk," or do you give it a sniff?
Oh, I definitely give it a sniff. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I would definitely take a look at it, smell it, see what's going on in there. You know, because, for instance, like in the establishment of labels on milk, it can be done different ways in different states, and different manufacturers handle it differently and so forth. But, you know, the manufacturers don't know if in your family you store the milk in the front part of your refrigerator on the door, which is the warmest spot. They don't know if your teenager stands there with the doors wide open and your refrigerator heats up and there your milk is getting warm.
They don't know if you drove an hour home from the grocery store
exactly, or
2 minutes home from the grocery store.
Right. They don't know if you pull the gallon of milk out and put it on the dinner table when your family eats and it's out for an hour every day at 70 degrees. You know, all of those things we might do at home influence the shelf life of foods.
Wow.
And, you know, there's no way that manufacturers could know or anticipate all those things. So that's just to say, you know, as a consumer, use your own judgment and also be conscious of the cost of what you're throwing out. You know, one thing that NRDC has found in our research is that people are very conscious of what they're paying at the grocery store for food, but then they're almost completely unaware of the fact that, you know, they're throwing out half a jar of whatever it might be, and in fact, that cost them $3.
Yeah. All right.
Right?
Well, lots more to talk about. Let's go to our listeners, 1-800-892-6477. Again, send us an email. We're talking about food waste today in the exchange, how it happens, how it's so big. And we'll talk in a couple minutes about strategies to reduce this waste. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And both of you, let's go to Keene. Scott is calling from there. Hi, Scott. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank
morning.
You. I was just curious about the relative impact of meat and animal product consumption on this issue, because meat is so resource intensive to bring to our tables, but also as a practical matter, when most people look in their refrigerator and they have vegetables that are a little bit old, they might decide to just cook them rather than eat them raw. But with meat, I imagine there's more that's tossed out because they're unsure.
You know, this is a great question, Scott. Thank you so much. And what do you think, Stephen? Are there certain foods that we tend to waste more because we're just more nervous about them, or we don't know what to do with them?
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair assumption. I think you know, people are probably a little bit more concerned with meat, a little bit more concerned with dairy. So I think the caller has a good point there. You know, all of them have an impact. You know, beef, animal products, dairy. You know, a lot of resources go into the production of those items, and especially water, right, and feed. So they are more resource intensive, as he notes. So. You know, any and all reductions in our food types would be good, but if we can limit the waste of those products, beef especially, it would be great.
So the cost, the environmental cost of food waste is especially great with meat because of all the resources involved in producing that meat, Stephen. That's
yep.
what you're trying to say. All right.
Yep.
Well, Scott, thank you for the question. And to Bethlehem, where David is on the air. Hi, David. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, no, I wanted to just real quick. I had when I talk about waste of food and what have you, you know, in Fort Dix, New Jersey, in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, in Fort Benning, New Jersey, Georgia, I've seen a mess sergeant will get an allotment for a certain amount of food for his canteen, and if he doesn't use it all, it gets dumped because he wants to make sure he's got the allotment for the next day and the next day. If he doesn't use it, then he feels he's not going to get the same amount the next day. And you got churches. You got Meals on Wheels. You got kids in schools that don't have the food. And I just think that maybe the government could do something about tightening up on that.
Well, that's interesting. David, thank you so much. And Joanne, what do you think, sort of large institutions and the way that they use or don't use food?
Sure. You know, well, I can't speak to the particular regulations that might apply on military bases, but I think David really raises an important point. You know, when you look at where food waste occurs in our food system, you know, we mentioned that consumers are the largest component of it, but institutional food service environments like colleges and nursing homes and hospitals, you know, other types of large facilities like that account for, you know, maybe roughly 10% of the losses that we see. And so there's really a growing movement among the businesses typically that run those organizations to figure out how to reduce their food waste. So, for instance, there's software that they can use that helps them track what's going to waste. You know, they can photograph and weigh and assign the dollar value of everything that goes wasted. And typically, you know, when you see a business being armed with that kind of information, it really allows them to manage those challenges.
David,
right?
Thank
it really
you.
Allows
yeah.
them to get on top of it.
Thank you for the call, David. And coming up, a lot more of your questions and comments. Also, a grocery store executive on the role of supermarkets in food waste. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, reducing food waste at every stage from farm to fork. An estimated 30 to 40% of food produced in this country is never eaten. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your comments, questions, observations, you can send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And along with our guests, Joanne Birkenkamp and Stephen Finn, we're joined now by Eric Bloom. He's Communications Manager for Hannaford Supermarkets. And Eric Bloom, welcome. Good to have you.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, when did Hannaford's first start to really address this issue of food waste?
Well, this is actually a very long-standing commitment from Hannaford. We were one of the founding members nationally of the Food Waste Recovery Challenge that the EPA started. So this has been a very long-standing concern of ours.
How much food does Hannaford waste?
Well, you know, one of the things we're extremely proud of, and it's brand new, is that 13 stores here in New Hampshire send absolutely no food waste at all to landfills.
And that's, no food and waste to landfills at all?
At all. The remainder of our stores, the other two-thirds of the stores in New Hampshire, really have been doing a remarkable job of reducing waste. As a matter of fact, last year, off a pretty strong base, we saw a 50% increase in the amount of food that we donated to hunger relief in New Hampshire.
So 50% increase in the amount of food you donate to hunger relief. And, you know, people listening would think, well, that's great. On the other hand, how does that affect your bottom line? That's food that you're not getting money for, that you don't sell.
Yeah, and what we do, and you're absolutely right, and what we do is we follow the EPA food recovery hierarchy, and the very top of that is do a good job of ordering food. Try and align the amount of food that you are going to be selling with the amount of food that you're going to be ordering. And so we work really hard at that because that's what we're in the grocery business. But having said that, any grocery store will find at times that there are items that are approaching their use-by date and are not going to sell. And so the next part of the hierarchy is make sure that every bit of the food that you can get that you're not going to sell goes to hunger relief. And that's really where a lot of our focus is.
Let's talk a little bit, if we could, about those use-by dates or sell-by date or best-consumed-by date. Because everybody in the food waste field, Eric, I'm sure you know, says this is a big problem, that there are really no standards, that this is, you know, created by manufacturers who have an incentive to get us to throw it out and buy more.
Well, you know, that's something that is governed at a more national level, but there are certainly concerns around food safety, and that's our number one concern. But we don't have a position on whether or not those should be changed. What we do have a position on is making sure that that things don't go to landfill. There's too many hungry people in New Hampshire. There's too many hungry people in this country to let that food go to waste.
So does Hannaford create those labels on any products, or is it really the manufacturers who create those, you know, sell by or consume by?
Generally a manufacturing item. There, you know, there's obviously in-store produced items. And, you know, as you alluded to, we're trying to make sure that, you know, we sell as much of the merchandise that we produce as possible. But for the most part, it is a manufacturer's issue.
A lot of the waste also comes in the supply chain before the grocery store, you know, slightly bumpy apples, crooked carrots, the so-called ugly produce that stores often won't accept, farmers just throw out. Does Hannaford sell this ugly produce at some of its stores, you know, on a table somewhere for a reduced price, you know, buy the crooked carrot?
Yeah. Well, I don't want to raise expectations in New Hampshire just yet, but I will say we are experimenting with that. We have a pilot program. It's actually in Albany, New York, where we are intentionally buying a fruit that you might call ugly. or you might call it fun or whatever, but it's not standard. And so we intentionally, in these cases, are going to farmers and saying, fruit or vegetable that you might have a little trouble selling elsewhere, we're going to buy it and we're going to sell it in our stores, as a specific category of items, and that's been going very well. But it is something that we have not introduced across the whole company yet. But frankly, I'm not sure I'm not aware of any retailer that has fully rolled that out across their footprint, but we are one of the first companies to be experimenting with
looking at it. Yeah, it's interesting because I watched a bunch of videos on this food waste issue yesterday and saw pictures of just, you know, tons and tons and tons of peaches and apples and whatever being just thrown out because they had a little bump on them or something. So I wanted to ask you about that. Anything else, Eric, that you want to make sure people know about this food waste issue?
Well, you know, it really does take the whole community. If you look at the concerns, it certainly is across the spectrum, as you said, from farm to fork. And I think all of us as individuals can be thinking about the way that we use food and making sure that, you know, at our homes we're buying the right amount, not too much of what we need, or, you know, finding good ways to use leftovers in the home. And certainly retailers such as ourselves have a responsibility to be reducing waste as much as we possibly can, and at the farm level, it's really going to take the whole spectrum of effort to address this problem.
All right, Eric, good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much. It's good to talk with you.
That's Eric Bloom, Communications Manager for Hannaford Supermarkets. You can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or 1-800-892-6477. And Joanne and Stephen, let's go right back to our listeners. And Lisa's calling in from Keene. Hi, Lisa. You're on The Exchange.
Hello.
Go ahead. Hi.
Hi. Hi. I was just listening to the man from Hannaford's. I want to give this disclaimer ahead of time. Hannaford's is my preferred grocery store, and I won't stop shopping there. But I do have one concern or issue, and that is that the produce, especially the unpackaged lettuce, for example, romaine lettuce and some of the herbs, parsley and cilantro, I think they wet them too much. You know, the mister comes on, they're soaking wet by the time I put them in my cart. I have to shake them out when I get home or spin them. But the spoiling process has already started. And I've left many notes at the courtesy counter about this, so I'm hoping that somebody will listen today. I just think that it's one of those things that we don't even think about.
You know, yeah. No, I'm so glad you called, Lisa, because that kind of makes me crazy, too, when it's sopping wet, right? And you know it's going to spoil faster. And I wish Eric were still on with us. But I'm wondering, Joanne, can you address that? I mean, it's kind of a balance because if it's not a little bit wet, it looks sort of limp and dry and maybe even brown. So what do you think, Joanne?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it is certainly a balancing act. And I'll tell you, you know, we see this with consumers as well when they think about how to store food at home. We've seen often that people feel a little confused about how to store things, whether it should be warmer or colder, you know, how you store vegetables to maximize their life and so forth. So, you know, one of the things that we see with consumers is a real need for information about how to properly store foods and also to preserve them. You know, there are things like, you know, when you bring home, you know, strawberries, for instance, you know, you shouldn't rinse them off and then put them in the fridge. Don't rinse them first for the exact reason that your caller spoke to, that for them to be wet in your refrigerator will hasten the process of them going bad on you. So it's important to think about how you can store most foods effectively to maximize their shelf life.
Well, and Stephen, to you, again, we just heard from Eric at Hannaford. How do grocery stores in other countries approach this? You know, Canada, Britain, France, I think you spent some time in Sweden. What are your observations there, Stephen?
Well, you know, Europe is always an interesting model for me. It's a different lifestyle, a different mindset, right? There's not so much of a premium on big sizes. And also, you know, if you just take the example of bread, right, many of us have had the experience where you go, you know, you shop for your bread in the morning, and it may not be there in the afternoon because there's not as much overproduction over there. There's a premium on freshness. Where people tend to shop more frequently for something like that. So not quite as much of the huge quantity mindset that we tend to have over here. More, I think wrapped up in all that is more evaluation on food, right? It's celebrated. It's prized for eating with someone and celebrating the moment. So, I think that all is part of a culture that values food more. That we tend to put more of the focus on abundance and big quantities here. And if our food goes bad, we think we can go ahead and replace it. We can fill it.
Well,
again,
on that point, when people have been to Europe, sometimes it's shocking to see their little teeny refrigerators, and they go to the grocery store every day or every other day. But many Americans don't have grocery stores right on their corners. Here in New Hampshire, for some folks, it's kind of an effort to get to the store. I'm lucky. I live in Concord. Grocery stores are close. But even I don't want to go to the grocery store every day or every other day. I want to go once a week and be done with it. So it seems like a lot, Stephen, to ask Americans to shop for food like Europeans when our whole system isn't set up that way.
Yeah, it is a different system, that's for sure. And so I think part of the value of calls like this and all of the work that NRDC is doing on the educational front goes to indicate the level of food wastage that's associated with our current system and with our current lifestyles, right? So as we said before, there's a balancing act to this. Our lifestyles and our values and, go indicate how much food we waste, right? They're all related. So, changing our lifestyles in various ways can lead to reduced waste across the system.
How big is your fridge, Stephen?
My fridge is typical of the American, mindset. Interestingly, if you look at, Sweden, for example, there's a concept that kind of underlies their society. It's called Lagom, L-A-G-O-M, and it translates to just enough. And so, that mindset sort of permeates culture, and it's more about we don't need tremendous quantities on hand all the time. We need just enough. And
yeah, but then again, my point is, I know a lot of folks who have to drive half an hour to the grocery store. So, there's an environmental impact to them driving back and forth all the time if they're buying, quote unquote, just enough.
Yeah, there's that, too. There's the way I like to think about this one, too, is, in addition to big quantities, we expect big varieties, too, right? So, and when we go to the grocery store at, say, 10 of 11 at night, we tend to expect that, all of the varieties of bread, for example, or baked goods will be there at 10 minutes to closing time, just as they were at the start of the day and throughout the day, right? And there's a tremendous cost to that, right? To keep those shelves stocked every minute of the day, requires a tremendous amount of resources. And at the end of the day, a lot of those items aren't going to get consumed, and they're going to get discarded because they're perceived as not fresh enough by, a picky consumer population. So we just need to be aware of that. And I think that awareness is going to help translate to behavior change.
Joanne, what do you think? How big is the size of your fridge? And I'm guessing you have a big freezer where you put stuff.
I also have a standard size refrigerator and freezer. It's true. There it is. I want to respond to these points because I think this is a really critical question. We do have a lifestyle that, it doesn't, I think, encourage us to live in this kind of just enough mentality that Stephen mentioned. But, for me, the thing really is, how do we sync our shopping habits with what we can realistically eat at home? Right? That's the question. So, can we, I find often when we shop, we're kind of aspirational shoppers, right? We want to save money. We want to try new things. We want variety. We want to get some healthier options. We want to try new recipes. We saw those dynamics, particularly among millennials, who have a lot of curiosity about different sorts of foods and maybe wanting to experiment with lots of different things. But so often, just because we're busy and our schedules may be unpredictable, many of us will end up, going out for dinner, or we go out with friends or something, rather than cooking as much as we might have expected. And so we buy all these ingredients, and then we just don't have a chance to prepare them. So for me, part of it is saying, look, really, how much am I going to eat out this week? How much am I going to be able to cook? And how much of that am I really going to be able to eat? So I think just being realistic with ourselves can be a big step in the right direction. And then secondly, something very simple like just going to the grocery store with a shopping list can be a huge help, right? And that's something I've done, you know, my whole life, just because my mother always had a shopping list. And she would always look in the fridge and figure out what was already in there, what she didn't need, and she knew what she was going to cook that week. And those are really easy steps that we can all take that don't take a lot of time and that really can help us save money too, right? Because it doesn't, you know, we don't save money if we're buying something that might be half the price, but then we waste half of it.
Well, let's go back to our listeners. And Mark is joining us from Portsmouth. Hi, Mark. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. I love your show.
Good. Go ahead, Mark.
I'm curious about your panel's experience with food waste technologies, such as there's one being made in Portsmouth called the BioGreen 360, presently in use in certain supermarkets and even at prison locations. I'm curious if they know anything about these types of technologies that are out there for recycling food waste for fertilizer and for things like that.
Is that what the BioGreen 360 does, Mark?
Yes, it does.
It recycles?
It breaks it down by enzyme and then dehydrates it into a shippable dry product that can be spread for, you know, land use and whatnot.
Okay. Or fed to the pigs, maybe, in some cases. I'm not sure.
I don't think they can really do that anymore.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I did see something about that online. So, Mark, thank you for calling in. Stephen, do you want to chime in there?
Yeah, there are a number of items like the BioGreen 60 and others being developed right now. Essentially, dehydrators that take the water out of food and reduce the excess waste to a very small quantity. So there's good developments there. I think they have a long way to go. I think if they really delivered on everything that they promised, I think they would be in much bigger use right now. I think they still need to work out the kinks on them, and I think there are issues in the water discharge from those units as well.
The water discharge might cause some water pollution, Stephen?
Yeah, you know, through the municipal systems, that sort of thing. So they're not a panacea, but I think there's good. You know, there's good potential for these to be developed further.
Well, and getting back to what we talked about, you know, fundamentally, you know, great that you're using wasted food in the BioGreen 360, but that takes fossil fuels, right, Stephen, to run the thing. And so, you know, not wasting it in the first place seems like the best solution.
Yep. You know, absolutely. It's a balancing act between the power that's needed to run them, too. But you're correct. The source reduction piece, reducing the upfront waste, is always the best solution.
Well, heading into a break, I just want to share a couple of great stories that we've gotten from our listeners. And thanks, everybody, so much. Grace says, when I was growing up, we would offer questionable food to the cat. If he turned it away, we would toss it. But if he wanted to eat it, we would eat it. Grace, thank you for that. I'll try that maybe at home. Here's one from Kate, who says, thanks for this timely issue. I have a bad kale habit. I buy it for smoothies, etc., then let it go yellow in the crisper. I have rescued and am sauteing the latest victim under the influence of your show. Thanks for waking me up and keep up the good work. Kate, thank you so much. We'll take more of your stories, question, comments in just a moment. We'll also check in with the New Hampshire Food Bank and how it is approaching this idea of food waste, given hungry people who would probably love to have the food to eat. All that's coming up, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, America's giant pile of wasted food. We've been looking at how this happens and all the environmental impacts, the wasted water, wasted fuel, wasted land, all to produce food that is never eaten. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, the number 1-800-892-6477. You know, we've talked a lot about the greenhouse gases that come from food sent to the landfill. We heard earlier from Hannaford's and gentlemen there who said they send nothing to the landfill. Joanne Birkenkamp, to you, what about composting? I mean, how many Americans compost to help reduce this problem?
Well, you know, when you look at food that is disposed of in the United States that goes through municipal solid waste, for instance, you know, about 95% of that is getting landfilled or incinerated, unfortunately, which from an environmental perspective is really the least desirable outcome because of the emissions, the difficulty of siting landfills in our peri-urban areas and so forth. So only about 5% is disposed of through other means like composting or anaerobic digestion. So it's quite small, but it is growing. More municipalities are starting to offer composting for residences. Like I live here in Minneapolis, and we can now compost our residential organic waste. So there are many more opportunities these days, but it does require, at the municipal level, you know, investments in centralized composting facilities, right? So, you know, we need kind of political commitment to doing that. And then there are also many opportunities for people to compost at home. And that's a very low-tech, low-cost kind of solution that many more people are embracing. And that's terrific for keeping that material out of the landfill.
Well, and my husband's an avid gardener, so of course we compost. But you're saying only 5% compost?
Yeah,
that seems amazing to me.
Yeah, of what goes through municipal solid waste. So if you're discarding it in your trash, you know, as a residential person who discards food, only about 5% of that material nationally is actually going somewhere other than into the landfill or incineration. So we've got a long way to go.
You said you live in Minneapolis, so a city dweller. I mean, you know, New Hampshire is largely suburban, rural. But if you do live in a city, you know, on the fifth floor or the 10th floor, how hard is it to compost? It's not as easy as, you know, me just going out the back door and dumping it.
No, I think it is a challenge for people who live in multifamily dwellings, apartments, and so forth. You know, there are strategies with vermiculture, or vermicomposting, rather, with composting with worms. You know, it's not for everyone, but that can be an option for people who really want to pursue that. But, you know, as was said earlier, the real benefit and the cost savings for folks really comes when you prevent that food waste in the first place. And so that's really, I think, the place for most of us to try to focus our efforts. And in fact, NRDC has been working in conjunction with the Ad Council, which, as you may know, created Smokey the Bear and Friends Don't Let Friends Drive Drunk and some of those really iconic social service campaigns to launch the first ever consumer education campaign around food waste. And it's called Save the Food. And it's an effort to really help inspire people who eat around how they can be part of the solution on this.
All right, let's go back to our listeners again. 1-800-892-6477. And Peg joins us from Tamworth. Hi, Peg. Thanks for calling into The Exchange. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I've just been sitting here thinking about the issue of food waste and having that same feeling about pollution and thinking, you know, you run around, you turn your thermostat down, you try not to leave your car running, you try to conserve energy. But when you really think about it, it feels like you can't do enough because a lot of pollution is what we call non-point, right? You can't contain it. You can't address it without going back to the source of where it's being produced. And I feel like with food, even though I do compost and I help run a farmer's market up here in Tamworth, and I have a small micro wood-fired bread business where I try to not have food wasted and not overproduce. Nonetheless, I feel like the issue is not so much with all of us as individual consumers as it is with what I would call big food. What if you've read Michael Pollan recently, talks about our $1.5 trillion industry in big food, centralized corn, soy production, and the fact that we have more of a disposal problem of overproduced food than we do of a food waste problem. And as you opened the show and you said in the 70s, we wasted less food because there was less of it to waste.
So overproduction now, is the problem. Peg, thank you for calling.
We have a capitalist system that favors overproduction.
Overconsumption, overproduction. Stephen Finn, what do you think?
I think Peg makes a good point. Overproduction is something we talk about a lot. I kind of alluded to it with the bread issue before about how we have these expectations as picky consumers to have a vast quantity of varieties on the shelves at all times. So And retailers and producers, strive to meet that need. So it is a big problem. It leads to a lot of waste. A lot of that, those, well-stocked supplies that are on the shelves that we see end up, getting discarded at the back of the store, right? So it's a big issue. It's a systemic issue, right? And I think I like to talk at times about how, we need, with increased education, and the campaign that Joanne alluded to before will certainly help with that, and we've got a long way to go with education efforts. But with increased education about the impact of food waste and the overproduction that tends to drive it, I think we can address this systemically and get these things more in line so we're not producing so much and wasting so much.
So if you point the finger, Stephen, at companies, as Peg says, companies are overproducing because they have a financial incentive to do so. But if we, the people, weren't overbuying, overconsuming, throwing stuff out, they wouldn't produce so much.
Yeah, and that's, I like to tell people it all comes down to the consumer. It all comes down to culture change. And I would encourage people as they get more, become more aware of this problem, ask questions, right? Retailers react to that. Go to your retailer, go to your favorite restaurant, go to your school, go to your representative, ask them what they're doing about food waste reduction, right? How do we get this issue firmly on the national agenda so that we're making progress, so that we're addressing these this issue systemically, right? It's a big system, and it's an incredibly important system. It's at the heart of everything that we do, right? The concepts are fairly easy. The detailed work is the hard part, right?
Right.
So, but it really needs to start with awareness.
And Peg, thank you so much for that call. Let's go to Gisela in Plymouth. Hi, Gisela. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. I really like your program. I am a famine survivor from after World War II in Germany.
Wow.
And needless to say, nothing gets wasted in our household, at least as little as possible. But my concern is this year we went apple picking, as we do every year. And we usually get the drop apples, and I get a great big bag full, and I make applesauce and apple leather with a hydrator. And we were told at the particular orchard that there's a new New Hampshire law, and we were not allowed to pick the drops. We could only pick fresh apples from the tree.
Wow, and there's a lot of apples on the ground, Gisela.
It's amazing and beautiful, I kept looking at those apples, and of course, we only got a few because they're so much more expensive when you pick them.
Sure.
And I kept looking at those and thinking, all these people in this state, all the children that go hungry, and there are the apples on the ground rotting. And I don't know whether whether that was correct that she told me that we couldn't, that there's a new New Hampshire law. I haven't had time to check it out. But if it's so, I'm really, really distressed about that.
So, Gisela, when you bought the apples from the ground before, you paid a reduced price for those?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. A big difference.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for calling in. And unfortunately, our guests aren't from New Hampshire, so they probably can't address that New Hampshire aspect of it. But, Joanne, just broadly, it seems like there's restrictions and so forth in place that discourage people from, buying the ugly fruit, so to speak.
Well, it's interesting on the question about the aesthetic appearance of fruits and vegetables. It's a somewhat different question than I think the caller just raised, which probably pertains more to food safety.
Sure.
And as you pointed out, I can't speak to that particular New Hampshire rule. But relative to fruits and vegetables that might look a little different, that are a little big or small, or have a little bump or a little scarring on the surface, that really is driven by consumer preferences. Right. And so for decades now, we've gotten accustomed to going into a grocery store and seeing everything is perfect and it all looks the same. Right. Same sizes, uniform colors and so forth. And we've really come to expect that is what grocers will provide to us. But, the reality, as she points out, is, nature produces foods that are not perfect. It doesn't all look alike. And anyone who's ever grown their own backyard garden has experienced that, right? Nature produces things that are not perfect and yet that are fresh and beautiful and wholesome and completely safe to eat. But our system has really channeled us into expecting things to be perfect. And that drives a lot of waste on farms. In fact, roughly one-sixth of all the food that gets wasted in the United States is fruits and vegetables that never make it off the farm. And there are a lot of things that drive that. It's standards around appearance of produce. It's things like sometimes the weather is really favorable and there are just a very abundant yields and the market isn't big enough to absorb them. Sometimes markets, farmers may not have enough laborers available to harvest that product when it's available during a very brief, you know, harvest season. So there are a lot of things that drive that, but we know that those losses are very significant. And back at the very beginning of the call today, one of your callers had asked about the relative amounts of different foods that are wasted. And in fact, in the United States, about 52% of the fruits and vegetables that are grown are never eaten.
Wow, that's
so much.
It's
one of the things that we waste the most of. Absolutely. And it starts on the farm. You know, no fault to our farmers, but there are losses that occurred there for various reasons. And like the caller who called in and said, ah, I got too much kale and it's turning yellow in my fridge. You know, it happens all the way through from farm to fork.
Well, I'm thinking about some pears right now that are on my counter at home and what I'm going to do with them because they're getting a little ripe. A couple great stories again from our listeners. Here's Josh who says, great show. The city of Portsmouth currently has a residential compost drop-off pilot program at our transfer station. And the Portsmouth City Council will be considering a residential curbside composting pilot program. So those are for folks who live, you know, right downtown and don't have a backyard to dump it in. Thank you so much for that, Josh. Here's Gloria in Peterborough who says, my millennial daughter has been trying to get me to reduce my food purchases for several years now. I've been throwing out less of it. So there she is buying less. Gloria says, additionally, I am starting up a project in my community to have people bring their extra bounty from their gardens to the local food pantry during local growing season. People are really excited about it, and the food pantry is thrilled to have fresh, locally grown produce. Again, she says thanks for the show, an important issue. Thank you for those emails. Let's take one more call if we could. Hannah's in Bradford. Hi, Hannah. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for doing the show. I just think it's such an important issue for all the reasons you mentioned, environmentally specifically. I run a food hub. I'm part of a food hub, the Kearsarge Food Hub. And a lot of what we do is to tackle this issue of food waste from the farm to the consumer. And one thing that we do is work with New Hampshire Greens, which is a program of our local conservation district. And they actually come to the farm and help you harvest things that are going to be wasted. And I wanted just to bring that up and also see if your guests had any other suggestions of resources that farmers could use to make sure that their food isn't wasted on the farm.
You know, Hannah, I'm so glad you called talking about gleaning, again, going through the field after the harvest and picking out all the stuff that doesn't get harvested for whatever reason. Joanne, can you jump in on that? Efforts nationally to improve gleaning?
You know, I think this is a fantastic question because, you know, many folks are increasingly interested in where their food comes from. They want to know their farmer, right? They want to have a connection to place and community and to the farms that surround them. And so gleaning has really been growing. And, you know, as you mentioned, it's a great opportunity for folks to go out to a farm that they might purchase from and harvest what otherwise is left in the field. And that is a really wonderful way for people to participate in their food system and also to make sure that some of that food gets to people in need through a local food pantry, for instance. So we're seeing an increase in the amount of food that's being donated. We're seeing an increase in food that's being gleaned from farms. And like another one of your callers said, you know, if you have a garden and you have a surplus, you know, you just get flooded with zucchini at a certain point in the year or tomatoes, you know, often a food pantry in your community might be willing to accept that food. And that's a great way to share that abundance with others. You know, particularly as we go into Thanksgiving season, I think we're all conscious of the abundance that we do have. And it's a wonderful way that you can share with others in your community.
Well, and perfect segue, because I wanted to ask both of you, and Stephen, I'll start with you, please. So here we are, as Joanne said, heading into a period of heavy food buying. And then maybe a week from now, looking in the fridge and going, uh-oh. What's your advice for folks listening today about, you know, heading to the grocery store to start preparing for Thanksgiving?
Yeah, Joanne alluded to it before. I think always the best thing to do before you go to the store as planned, right? It's a great, and I think no week reinforces that more than Thanksgiving week or Christmas, New Year's type weeks. You know, you're planning for a lot of people. You're buying a lot of food, and you don't want to run out, right?
So, right. You don't want to run out of snacks and have somebody, be upset.
Yeah. And so, take an inventory before you leave and make a list because otherwise you'll probably buy 2 to 3 times as many items as you need. So planning is definitely a key at this point. And, beyond just planning what you need for the meal, go into those meals with a mindset that says, how am I going to use up what I have that's left? You're always going to have leftovers. One of the great things about Thanksgiving is the leftover sandwiches the next couple of days, right? But go into that with a mindset of, I'm going to use this food responsibly, and I'm going to freeze, and I'm going to chop things up and process them in different manners, soups, stews, whatever. But there are, with planning, there's a lot that the individual consumer can do to reduce the wastage around this time of year.
Joanne, real quick, your advice for Thanksgiving.
Well, so here's my advice. I have a good friend whose family does this. When they throw family gatherings like Thanksgiving, every member of the family shows up with Tupperware in hand. And at the end of the meal, they all take something home. And it's a fantastic way to kind of share that bounty, continue the celebration, and make sure that nothing goes to waste. And the other thing I would suggest is do check out the SaveTheFood.com website. There are a lot of tips for consumers there about how to store food, how to tell if it's still good to eat, things like recipes to use up those leftovers.
All right.
As well.
Great. Well, and if you've got tips that you want to share with everybody, remember our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at NHPR.org. And the Exchange is on Instagram. Check out NHPR Exchange for behind-the-scenes photos and links and so forth. Joanne, Stephen, thank you so much for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.